just this weekend in announcing that Ibrahim was the new caliph of the Islamic State. In the very announcement, the Muslims said, and I'll share parts of it in a moment, that we have absolutely nothing to do with Al-Qaeda. In fact, the Islamic State is, and we'll go into this more today as well, is almost 1,000 times more appealing, more successful, larger than Al-Qaeda ever was. They were never related. The Islamic State doesn't ever cite Al-Qaeda. It doesn't promote any of Al-Qaeda's agenda. There is absolutely no connection of any kind between the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda. And it is now known everywhere that that's the case. So why would some nincompoop writing for the Washington Post, which, you know, used to be a respected periodical, talk about a Sunni insurgency inspired by Al-Qaeda? I mean, when Katharine Graham owned the Washington Post, it was a respectable newspaper. And I realize she just sold it to Jeff Bezos, who's the founder of Amazon. So I've got to wonder, are its writers now getting their journalism degrees from the Herbal Healer Academy? Well, Prime Minister, according to the Washington Post journalist, Malaki is trying to prevent the breakup of Iraq in the face of an offensive by heavily armed insurgents who have already declared an Islamic State stretching across Iraqi and Syrian territory. No, Malaki is not trying to prevent the breakup of the government. In fact, exactly the opposite. He doesn't want it. He is happy with the Kurds having their realm and the Sunnis having their realm and he having control of his realm. He is not a peacemaker. Everything you can hear about Malaki, he's saying, you know, it's my way or the highway. Goes on to say the threats to Iraq's territorial integrity are many as the Kurds are prepared to vote on independence farther north and the Shiite dissatisfaction bubbles in the south. So with 150,000 Shiite mujahideen armed to the hilt and commanded by the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani, an Iranian mullah that's in charge of Iraq, the most dominant political and religious figure in Iraq, with him saying that they ought to go out and hunt down and kill Sunni Muslims. Would you call that bubbling dissatisfaction? When according to the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani, you know, since we can't rely on the Shiite army that America has given us, we're going to pick up our arms as a Shiite militia, and we're going to go fight and kill. Not only in some cases fighting the army itself, and in other cases fighting Sunnis. Would that be bubbling dissatisfaction? I mean, bubble's kind of a fun word to say. But how would anybody in their right mind write bubbling dissatisfaction? Goes on to say, with violence engulfing the country, Malaki on Wednesday offered an amnesty to Sunni tribesmen who have joined the insurgency, his latest attempt to claw back into control. He's in control. In fact, in the parliamentary elections, he gained even more seats in the parliament than he had previously. He now has 97. He's the dominant party in Iraq. His party is the party of Sharia, a fundamentalist Islamic party, and he's the dominant vote-getter once again. He's not trying to claw himself into power. Unless he chooses, of his own volition, to give up power, then he doesn't need to do any clawing. There isn't anyone other than the Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani who could influence a lot of Shias that can counter him. In his weekly televised address, the embattled prime minister called on tribal leaders to stand beside the or stand behind the Iraqi state. Although that he said that in cases of spilled blood, it would be up to the victims' families to decide whether the tribesmen should be forgiven. So he wants Iraq to be completely anarchistic. Let everyone take vengeance into their own hands. But this strikes me as the same way that the Kiev government's amnesty provisions struck me. If you capitulate to independence, you say, we'll no longer fight for independence. You give us all of your guns. You surrender to us. We won't prosecute you. Oh, boy. Can you imagine people that have come to despise the Kiev government, people who have come to despise for good reason the Shiite government in Iraq, because the Shiite government routinely sent its army to bombard Sunni communities, saying, yeah, you know, since the only way that we have to defend ourselves is our weapons, and since we're beating you on all fronts, what we think that we're going to do is go back to the situation where you're firing artillery at us, attack helicopters at us, and bombing and destroying our cities. And we think the smart move would be then to trust you to surrender our weapons and stand behind the government that has harassed us. I mean, that's the exact same situation in the Ukraine. This idea that this is a truce and an amnesty is being offered is just ludicrous. Why would you even cover it? The United States, this again, Washington Post, I'm convinced that the writers now do get their journalism degrees from the Herbal Healer Academy. The United States successfully brought Sunni tribesmen on board to battle al-Qaeda as part of the Sunni awakening movement starting in 2005. But Malaki, a Shiite, has not kept up payments or fulfilled promises to incorporate Sunnis into the security forces, stirring resentment. Every bit of that is a lie. And you have to be unbelievably stupid to have written that. 2006 and 2007 is when the Sunni and Shias, both armed by America, were killing each other by the tens of thousands in street battles throughout Iraq. They didn't fight al-Qaeda. There was no al-Qaeda in Iraq. The United States successfully caused Sunni tribesmen with weapons that America had supplied to fight and kill Shias. And they did so. I mean, read the history of what happened after the awakening in 2006 and 2007. It was a bloodbath. I mean, you just got to be stupid. I mean, where do you go? If you want to write for the Washington Post, you go and hand your resume and it says right at the top, I am really stupid, so I'm qualified to work here? He has also faced oppositions from Shiites themselves, including Sarki in Karbala, which is how this story began, which is 55 miles southwest of Baghdad. Iraqi forces attempted to enter Sarki's compound. You know, religious leaders have compounds just after midnight. And his armed supporters, because, of course, he's a Muslim religious leader, you have to have your own private militia, battled them for 9 hours. Helicopters were brought in to fire upon the compound. This is a Shiite cleric being fired upon by a Shiite army. It was not immediately possible to confirm the death toll, which Iraqi news media put at around 14. Sharkey, who split from the anti-American Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sattar in 2004, posted pictures of slain supporters on his official website. Other photos showed what was described as burning Iraqi military Humvee. The Iraqis, by the way, don't make Humvees. That would be an American Humvee that was given to the Iraqis. Now imagine this now. The government is fighting with its army a Shiite cleric who is in opposition to the most venomous Shiite cleric in the world today, Muqtada al-Sattar. You know, the pictures in Fallujah where Americans were burned alive, where their charred bodies were hung on the bridge, where they were dragged down the street with women and children striking them and spitting on them. That was all orchestrated by Sattar. He's the second highest-ranking Muslim cleric in Iraq. He is in control of the largest Shiite militia in Iraq, over 50,000 strong. Some say as many as 100,000 strong, all with fancy uniforms and armed to the hilt again, and they call themselves the Mahdi Mujahideen. And this guy is a Shiite that actually opposes the most vicious of the Shiite leaders. And the Iraqi government, using American weapons, is attacking him. Talk about screwed up. After the clashes, Kabbalah, home to one of Shiite Islam's most revered shrines, was on lockdown, with cars banned from the roads as security forces, this would be the army, attempting to clear the area. Sarki has expressed opposition to Iraq's leading Shiite cleric, Grand Ayatollah al-Sistani, as well. And he's called on, who has called on all able-bodied Iraqis to take up arms against the Sunni insurgents. And by the way, he hasn't called on all able-bodied Iraqis. He called on Shiites to take up arms against the Sunnis. This is the mess that America made. You don't go back in to make this mess even worse. When we return, we're going to talk about a really despicable man. Chalabi is his name. He was a favorite of the Bush administration. He's the reason that we were beguiled into invading Iraq. Well, he is a whisper from becoming the Iraqi prime minister. This is another article from the Washington Post. It begins, he took millions of dollars from the CIA. Yeah, if you want to know a despicable organization engaged in malfeasance the world over, you really don't have to look much further than the CIA. You want to look for corruption. You want to look for sponsors of corruption. You want to look for those who squander Americans' integrity and its taxpayers' money. The CIA is a good place to start. If you wanted to make America safer and more secure, one of the first things you would do is eliminate the CIA. Well, this article, Washington Post, he took millions of dollars from the CIA, founded and was accused of defrauding the second largest bank in Jordan. Yeah, bank fraud. Why not? And he sold the Bush administration a bill of goods on weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Yes, he was the guy that the Bush administration said was a credible resource that was an insider that proved that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction. Of course, after squandering $2 trillion and thousands of lives to verify the claim, we found out, oh, well, Chalabi was a liar. At first championed by the Bush administration's neoconservatives as a potential leader of Iraq, Ahmad Chalabi ended up a persona non grata, effectively barred from the wartime American embassy there. Now, in an improbable twist of fate, Mr. Chalabi is being talked about as a serious candidate for prime minister of Iraq, one of two being positioned to replace Malaki. With Sunni insurgents ramping up their cause across the country and sectarian killings on the rise, everything old seems to be new again, including, apparently, Mr. Chalabi. Along these lines, the Obama administration said that more than 200 troops had been sent in to protect the American embassy in Baghdad and the Baghdad airport. The additional troops who arrived on Sunday will operate helicopters and drones, armed drones, to bolster airfield and route security. In addition to those forces, another 100 troops are headed to Baghdad to help with security and logistics. Oh, yes, the original 100 to protect the Americans who number 5,000 in the U.S. Embassy there. And another 100 that were going to be security analysts. Well, now that number is up to 750. But who's counting? As Iraq's political parties held meetings to try to agree on a new government, Mr. Chalbi's name was one of two being prominently mentioned to replace the incumbent prime minister. Mr. Chalbi's Iraqi National Congress, remember how that was always in the news? That was the American favorite. In fact, the CIA gave Mr. Chalabi millions upon millions of dollars to promote his Iraqi National Congress to be the secular party and the American vision of a new Iraq. Well, you know how many seats in the parliament America got for the tens of millions of dollars that it gave to the Iraqi National Congress? One. One out of 300 and some odd. One. And it's Mr. Chalbi seat, that's his seat. Not a single other participant. And just think of it. What is the United States doing, sponsoring political parties? You know, you're going to go into a country and you're going to say, oh, we're here to give you freedom. And then you have the CIA back one candidate over others. What kind of a game are we playing? Well, this article does say that Mr. Chalabi's Iraqi National Congress has only one seat in parliament, his own. Quote, our candidates for prime minister are Abdel Abdul Mahdi or Ahmed Chalabi, said Hakim al-Zamili, the leader in the parliamentary bloc of the Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sattar. How can you keep from laughing at this? At this point, the Islamic cleric most responsible for having his Shia Mujahideen kill Americans, torture Americans, defecate, just totally ravage, humiliate, savage Americans in Iraq. Well, his political candidate, the one that he wants to run, happened to be the same guy that George Bush and the CIA promoted. The CIA is now on the side of al-Sadr. Oh, what a wicked web we weave. The alliance is trying to persuade the state of law, that party, that would be the state of Sharia party of Mr. Malaki, who is, of course, a Shiite, to stand aside for another Shiite. So this alliance of the CIA and Muqtada al-Sattar, the most vicious Shia warlord in Iraq, that alliance is with Chalabi. You can't really say in his National Congress because it only has one seat. It's a great sponge for American taxpayer money. That the alliance, which is essentially a spokesperson for Sadr, is saying, if the state of Sharia refuses to accept one of our two candidates, then we will form a government with the Sunnis. Now, that ain't going to happen. There is not a Sunni on the planet that is going to ally with al-Sadr, the junior Ayatollah in Iraq. On the face of it, Mr. Chalabi as prime minister seems at best absurd. His exile-based, CIA-financed Iraqi National Congress never built any kind of a following in Iraq. And he suffered from Americans' growing unpopularity as the war dragged on. His role in promoting what many now recognize is a concocted evidence of weapons of mass destruction under Saddam Hussein badly tarnished his credibility. And, of course, because Bush bought it or wanted to buy it or wanted to promote him, you know, close to 1 million people have died. Only a year after the invasion, American Special Forces raided his home in Iraq. Yeah, this was the guy that George W. Bush was in bed with. And so American Special Forces raided his home in Iraq because America came to recognize that he was a spy for Iran. That's why he is tied up now with the Iranian Shiite leader. Spurned by the Americans, he became an ally of Mr. Sadr. No, you got it wrong. He was always an ally of Mr. Sadr. He was playing both sides. Mr. Chalabi, 69, put skills honed during the long years of exile in Washington as a communicator and backroom operator to good use, though, forging alliances with the followers of Sadr and their Iranian patrons, along with the Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani, the Shiite supreme religious leader. Mr. Malaki's State of Sharia Party gained the biggest number of seats in the April 30th elections and now claims 95, somewhat short of the 165 needed to make a majority. But Mr. Malaki has not lost support, or has lost some support from the Shiite clerics who have asked him to step aside. Mr. Malaki's State of Sharia supporters say the arithmetic is on the incumbent side, and they scoff at suggestions that other candidates could replace him, even if other parties don't attend the first session with the state, which would be the Sunnis and the Kurds. Because if you have a majority without the Shia and the Kurds, his 95 is enough by itself to form a government. Some say they want to see Malaki leave for someone whom all Shiites can coalesce around. That could either be some other figure in his party or more likely someone from one of the other Shiite parties, most likely from the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq. Oh boy, wouldn't that be better? Dateline Dubai. This is from Reuters. We hinted at this story yesterday and the one that began to cover the one that follows, but I want to continue to make this point because it's one where the entire world now hangs in the balance, where this, if I'm right, is going to continue to fester until it becomes world war. Billions, I suspect, are going to die as a result of what is occurring, and so it's important that we know the facts. So from Dubai, Reuters is reporting that the leader of the Islamic State in Iraq, Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, of course they don't know his name, that isn't his name, vowed revenge for what he said were wrongs committed against Muslims, calling on fighters to avenge them. This has really been the Islamic position for all time. They are the perpetrators. They're the aggressors. They're the savages. They're the ones who are wrong. And yet they blame everybody else for wrongs committed against them. You look at the Muslim Arabs in Israel. They claim that they have been wronged. And yet they're the ones who are always wrong. It's this inverted view of the world, this inability to see oneself as oneself really is. Islam makes its followers perverse. Violent jihadists, killers, kidnappers, slave traders, rapists. It is what Islam does to those it infects. Islam is wrong. jihadists are wrong. They haven't been wronged other than by themselves. Islamic clerics continue to wrong Muslims. But it's not outsiders that are wronging them. They're wronging non-Muslims. But that's never the view that is promoted by Muslims. They're always justified in their viciousness because they have concocted some myth that they have somehow been wronged. It just isn't true. Baghdadi, who is actually Ibrahim, was also speaking for the first time since his group renamed itself the Islamic State. He actually didn't speak for himself. He had a spokesperson speak for him. He called on all Muslims to immigrate to the Islamic State, saying it was a duty. You see, in Islam, there is no choice. Everything is a duty. Everything is an obligation. That's what the Quran says. Don't take my word for it. Read the Quran. Everything is a duty. Everything is an obligation. There is no choice. There is no free will in Islam. This article was from CNN, and this is the one that we were discussing yesterday as the program faded in and out due to technical challenges. It begins in a bold declaration of its ambition. The leadership of the global Islamic movement called the Islamic State ordered Muslims worldwide to swear allegiance to its leader, Caliph Ibrahim. By claiming such preeminence, the Islamic State is seeking to eclipse al-Qaeda and its leader, Ayman al-Zawahiri, in what analysts see as the most dramatic shift in militant jihadism since 9/11. You know, when you see the word analyst before an analyst, plural, you need to know that the columnist has no clue. And so they make some phone calls on the Rolodex to say, all right, who can I get a quote from? And if they didn't get a quote that really works well for them, then they summarize based upon what they want to convey. There has never been a meaningful al-Qaeda movement. Very few Islamists have ever been allied with al-Qaeda. And the only time that there was a significant alliance with al-Qaeda was during the late 1970s and throughout the 1980s into the early 1990s, when the American CIA was using al-Qaeda to recruit jihadists from around the world to participate in the Great Jihad in Afghanistan. That was its high watermark. From there, it has only dwindled and dwindled rapidly in terms of its overall influence. So this idea that that ISIS views al-Qaeda as a rival is just stupid. And by every possible measure, the Islamic State is preeminent over the high watermark of al-Qaeda, which was over 20 years ago. So right now today, ISIS is probably 1,000 times more popular, more successful, more empowered, better armed, with more adherents, with a larger following than al-Qaeda was at its prime 20 years ago. That's the difference here. Al-Qaeda never had any territory. The Islamic State has enormous territory. Al-Qaeda never tried to govern any community. The Islamic State is governing 50, 100 cities. The Al-Qaeda never raised more than tens of millions of dollars. And the Islamic State has raised billions of dollars. Al-Qaeda never had significant amounts of American weaponry. Those were typically given to the Taliban fighters. And yet, the Islamic State has billions of dollars worth of America's most sophisticated weapons, both given to them indirectly through Saudi Arabia and Qatar as they fight in Syria to oust Assad, and then confiscated in Iraq as the American-equipped Iraqi army retreats. They are different by a thousandfold. And that's the problem. We're not putting this genie back in the bottle. America created this mess. The Islamic State initially rose in the wake of America's invasion of Iraq when it became possible in Iraq for the first time for Muslims to gather together in militias, something that Saddam Hussein had prevented. It grew from Sunni tribesmen into the Islamic State. And it has continued to grow, particularly because of what America has done in Syria. We'll be back in a moment. Yes, the declaration was made on Sunday. It was a 34-minute audio message where the Islamic State spokesman, Abu Muhammad al-Shami, said that from now on, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria would simply be called the Islamic State. This stripped away any of the political limits that were imposed by the previous name, which means they are not going to limit themselves to Iraq and Syria. They consider their position to be much greater than that, simply an Islamic State. In a direct challenge to al-Zawahiri, al-Shami said it was now incumbent upon all Muslims to pledge allegiance to the Caliph Ibrahim and support him. By the way, that's not a direct challenge to Ayman al-Zawahiri. Ayman al-Zawahiri knows that he doesn't have 200 people in the world that have pledged allegiance to him. And Caliph Ibrahim has tens of thousands, maybe hundreds of thousands, could be millions, most likely millions, that have pledged their support to him. I mean, this is different, again, by a thousand to one. Caliph Ibrahim is the new name now given to al-Baghdadi. Now, that's not true. He was born Ibrahim. Al-Baghdadi was just a slogan that was a kind of a title, like Ibrahim is from Baghdad, so he was called the one from Baghdad. Now, his name is Ibrahim, so he's going by the name, his original name. A secretive figure never seen in ISIS voluminous propaganda output. Thus, he is the imam, this is the quote, and the caliph of every Muslim everywhere, al-Shami concluded, with brevity, he would be the caliph of Sunni Muslims if, in fact, the Islamic State is here to stay. Al-Shami said that in areas now controlled by the group, the legality of all states and organizations becomes null and void. In other words, northern and eastern and southern, with exception of southwestern Syria, is now the Islamic State. It is no longer Syria. Northern and western Iraq is now the Islamic State. It is no longer Iraq. The restoration of the caliphate was the dream of al-Qaeda leader. This again, Washington Post. No, this is CNN, I'm sorry. They also have Nimrods, too. Leader Osama bin Laden in establishing al-Qaeda. That is not true. Osama bin Laden's principal mantra was getting secular Muslims and infidels out of the Islamic world. So he did not like the American military bases in Saudi Arabia. That's why they're no longer there. He did not like Saddam Hussein in Iraq because he was a secular dictator and wanted to go to war with him. That was his primary mantra. That's why in Afghanistan he worked to oppose the Russian-backed government. He only then secondarily became an antagonist against the United States because George W. Bush prevailed in convincing the Saudi Arabian warlords to use the American military as opposed to al-Qaeda to push Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait. So he was not a caliphate sort of guy. He never saw himself as being caliph of a unified Islamic world. In language that appears to taunt al-Qaeda and al-Nusra, perhaps, al-Shami said Sunday, they never recognized the Islamic State to begin with. Now, if they never recognized the Islamic State, if al-Nusra never recognized the Islamic State or al-Qaeda never recognized the Islamic State, then it cannot be possible that the Islamic State was a offshoot of al-Qaeda. It can never be said that they were inspired by al-Qaeda if they never recognized the Islamic State to begin with. And that's as clear as words allow. Although America, Britain, and France acknowledge the Islamic State's existence, al-Qaeda wouldn't even acknowledge its existence. It cannot be a splinter, an offshoot of al-Qaeda. So should we consult with those who have betrayed us, those who have disowned us, those who have incited against us? This goes on to say that al-Qaeda's declining potency in its Afghan-Pakistan heartland and the death of bin Laden and the group's fracturing into semi-autonomous franchises have left a new generation of jihadists looking for a spiritual home and a field of combat. Is provides that, a slick propaganda machine producing.